Hi, my name is Lauren Templeton, and you are listening to Investing the Templeton Way. This podcast is for anyone interested in learning more about investing. In this podcast, I will be interviewing some of the greatest minds from the investment community and exploring topics ranging from international markets to behavioral finance. To learn more, please visit us at investingthetempletonway.com. The information presented in this podcast or available on the website is not intended as and shall not be construed as financial advice. This podcast is produced for entertainment value. Investing is inherently risky, and I encourage you to seek financial advice from a professional who is aware of the facts and circumstances of your individual situation. Thanks for listening.
All right, so I would like to start by welcoming everyone. I'm your host, Lauren Templeton, and I have a fantastic guest for you today, none other than Mr. Robert Robotti. Bob is the president and chief investment officer of Robotti & Company. Prior to forming Robotti & Company, Bob was vice president and shareholder of Gabelli & Company. He worked in public accounting before coming to Wall Street and is currently an inactive CPA. Bob holds a BS from Bucknell University and an MBA in accounting from Pace University. Some of Bob's areas of coverage include special situations, energy industry, and home building. Bob is the principal of the managing member or general partner of several investment vehicles. So welcome, Bob.
Hi, Lauren. Great to be here. Appreciate it.
I know. I think the last time I saw you, and this is no exaggeration, you were dancing somewhere in India. We were there together.
There's plenty of reasons to dance if you're in a place like India. So
that's true. Bob and I went on the trip of a lifetime together to India with a group of investors. And we traveled from New Delhi. We, of course, went to Agra and saw the Taj Mahal. We went to Jaipur, Bangalore, and ended up in Mumbai. And if memory serves correctly, you extended your trip to India. Is that right?
I did. That's right. We did spend an extra week. So that's right. I was there in total 2 weeks. So it was a long way to go. So therefore, I figured I'd capture as much opportunity as I can.
Yes, you have an advantage. I had to get home and relieve my mother, who is keeping our children. So I'm glad you enjoyed the trip to India. I look back on the trip very fondly. Of course, this trip was related to Fairfax, and I missed you at the Fairfax meeting this year, but I assume you're packing your bags to head to Omaha.
That's right. I will be in Omaha. Last week, I was in Calgary. I had my own board meetings I had to attend and shareholder meeting I had to chair on Thursday also. So I had a second obligation that overrode the ability to be there in Toronto with Fairfax and you.
Well, you were in Canada, so that's close enough.
Okay.
Tell me about your pilgrimage every year to Omaha. This is a question I ask a lot of my guests. What do you get out of going to the annual Berkshire Hathaway meeting? What are your favorite events to attend?
It's such an odd thing in many ways, right? Because what ends up happening is I end up in Omaha, and I end up seeing people from New York, many of them I haven't seen in probably a year. So we travel all the way to Omaha, end up seeing each other as opposed to going downtown and hopping on the subway and seeing each other. So, but of course, it's not just people from New York. There's people from all over. So just the nature of the people, the character of the situation, the ability to exchange information, to meet new people, to extend and broaden the networks you already have. And, you know, it's invaluable. It's really a great thing. So, of course, I always want to be at the Fairfax meeting, too. That's another opportunity. And actually, I also go to the Markel meeting. Actually, we are holding an investor event this year right before the Markel meeting. Again, these are places where people congregate who are like-minded and you know, great connections and great people to talk to. Therefore, again, broaden who you know and what you know.
I agree. I need to go to the Markell meeting. I get a lot out of attending the Berkshire Hathaway AGM and will bring my children and former intern this year with me. I'm disappointed that we may not have great weather, though. I think it's supposed to rain, so definitely pack a rain jacket, Bob.
Okay. Well, I wasn't going to spend a lot of time out hiking, so it'll mitigate that problem.
That's true. Maybe more people will stay for the full meeting instead of coming in the morning and leaving. Well, I am always interested in how people got started in investing, and I know a little bit about your story with a background in accounting, and I believe you worked on the audit for Tweedy Browne. Is that correct?
That's right. That was my introduction. I was working on the audit for Tweedy Browne for many years, meeting the people there when, you know, back Ed Anderson ran the firm. Chris Brown was still a young rookie. Will Brown wasn't even there. John Spears had just joined. Walter Schloss, of course, was sitting in the other room. And his son, Eddie Schloss, was my age. So therefore, you know, they sat at a desk. And that's what I did, is I knew what Tweedy Browne owned, what they bought, what they sold. And one of the retired partners was there. And that's where the auditors would be, in the room with him. And so he became my mentor in the business. So that's how, that was my introduction to investing. It was not through school and education and finance classes, fortunately, because I probably would have been corrupted by some crazy ideas. Instead, it was what Tweedy owned, why they owned it, and understanding that, and what Walter Schloss owned too. So
that is an amazing experience.
Yes.
What a way to get started in the industry. And so what did you, I mean, Tweedy Browne, obviously, very well-known value investing firm. What did you see in their investment philosophy that just attracted you to valuation, valuing assets, et cetera?
Well, I guess it, of course, it, you know, here I am an accountant, so therefore it made it particularly easy. So, you know, to calculate book value and things like that, you know, pretty easy to do, straightforward. So I could kind of understand and grasp some of the concepts pretty easily. Of course, it was also a time when valuations were different. So therefore, you know, there were many securities that traded at very discounted valuations to assets. And of course, assets are a really imperfect judge of what future cash flows of the business are. And so therefore, you know, there's totally limitations to using a balance sheet approach to picking good investments. But at the time, given the circumstances, it was an easy way to do it and an easy way to learn it for someone who could calculate book value and net working capital and things like that were relevant. And that was this investment selection process that worked back then.
True. I always advise young people that they should minor or have a dual major in accounting. So I think if you do have that background, there's a, you'll kind of always have a job. And if you want to go work in finance, you really need to understand the accounting. So I think that's such good advice.
Well, I guess Warren, I'm pretty sure he's quoted as saying, you know, accounting is the language of business. Mm-hmm. So you need to understand the language to be able to converse it.
It is true. Well, what are we thinking about today's market? Yesterday was a heck of a day in the market. There's a lot of volatility. I have heard you say this is the revenge of the old economy, revenge of the stock picker. So give me your views on the market today and what's going on. Are you finding a lot of value,
sure,
picking up a lot of opportunities?
So yes. So, you know, we think, So first off, right, our historic focus has really been, and our core competencies really are in industrials, materials, plenty of those have commodity exposures. So what we see happening is we actually see the revenge of the old economy. That's what we call it. Part and parcel with that, we also see the revenge of the stock picker. So after a decade-long capital flows, we think that capital is in the process of starting to reposition, and therefore we think there's a significant opportunity set. You know, and again, these are companies in our universe that, you know, have single PE multiples. They have strong free cash flows, fortress balance sheets as a result of those things. And we think that due to structural changes in many of these businesses and environmental concerns, there's barriers to entries in this business too, something that people always look for in a growth investment, right? And we think the competitive landscape has consolidated down dramatically, and therefore there is thoughtful capital allocation that therefore has sustainability to these companies and their current situation.
Well, that's very interesting. I've heard you walk through the example of Westlake. Is that a position that you still own?
We do. And of course, we do tend to own things for long periods of time. I guess I followed the company since it went public. Was it back in 04? And so we've owned it for probably over 10 years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we tend to stay involved with companies for longer periods of time. So, Lauren, one of the things that's really interesting today is I really think the macro environment is creating dramatic opportunities, right? Because we're in, I would say, a unique period. What happened post the financial crisis is you had this decade-plus pandemic-long period of odd economic activity, like I'd say unique in kind of history. And things happened from that have set the stage today that, you know, people don't understand the difference between what's a cycle and what's secular change. And because the cycles lasted so long, there are people who think a cyclical environment, it really is a permanent change. And so, and most importantly, you see that in interest rates. And so the world's changing. The world's in the wrong spot. And you kind of know that, right? It was back 2011 letter, is Buffett's letter. And after that, in 2012, right, Fortune wrote an article that talked about Buffett, talked about interest rates, where he observed that bonds were, they were priced to be a return-free risk. Price is the critical word. Valuation matters. And that's one of the things we think that people have lost sight of. Valuation really does matter. And that's a critical element in making investment decisions today.
Yeah, I obviously agree with you on that. Valuation always matters. It matters what you pay for an asset.
Yeah.
And it may take some time to work that out. But you will eventually learn that lesson if you don't pay attention to valuation.
Yeah.
So building on the last question, if we look outside of the U.S., the discounts are materially compelling. For instance, the MSCI ACWI ex-USA trades at a 32% discount on a PE basis. And these discounts look uniform across the various regions and economies. Are you finding better bargains in international markets? I know you have various products, but how are you positioned? Are you overweight the U.S. or are you finding more value in international markets? Where are you going hunting right now?
The answer is kind of yes and yes. Predominantly, though, my investments are concentrated in North America. That said, one of my colleagues, Isaac Schwartz, is 15 years. He's been running an international fund, lived in Asia for 6 years and travels extensively. And so, you know, that's what we see is capital flows have gone to, everybody says the phrase, everybody knows the phrase, past performance is not an indicator of future results. Well, the fact of the matter is a lot of capital doesn't follow that. Capital moves to things that have performed well, and it is a trailing indicator, and that has moved out of places like small cap U.S. markets, but it's also clearly moved out of foreign markets also, right? Mm-hmm. So U.S. large cap stocks have been the stellar performers for such a long period of time. The pull on capital has dramatically changed the valuation differential. So there's a huge opportunity set. And so I know some of those companies, but Isaac spends more time kind of on a day-to-day basis. So he'd probably be a great person to have on since he does travel extensively and invest extensively overseas. And that, you know, I have a lot of capital invested with him. And so therefore, I really think that's a clear, opportune place today to get some great investments at much more attractive valuation metrics than what you're going to be able to get in U.S. public markets.
Yeah, it's a great idea. And I'd love to have him on as a guest. So I'll let you try to help me with that.
Yeah.
In regards to international markets, Bob, China appears heavily discounted, giving some investors pause due to regulatory changes. How do you view China's opportunity set for value investors in 2022? I just read a great book called Red Roulette, which I don't know if you've read it yet, but a lot of people are reading it. It's a beachy read, and it's a very eye-opening book about business practices in China and the Chinese Communist Party. But I'm just interested if you have any color on China or any thoughts on China.
Got to have some thought on China. So that was one of the advantages of also of Isaac investing overseas and moving overseas is that it gave me the opportunity to visit with him regularly. So I would spend, while he lived there, I would spend 5 weeks a year, a full week, and I would visit all the countries and he would take me around. So we started in Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, Vietnam, Philippines, Indonesia, Hong Kong, of course, 12 different cities in mainland China, South Korea, Japan, Mongolia. So it took me all over the place. Then talking to those companies, the managements, you know, we'd meet with five or six managements a day. So therefore, you really get a lot of information about business in Asia. And of course, it is a flat world, in spite of the fact that, you know, it's maybe bumping a little bit. It's still a flat world and we're all interrelated. So understand what goes on in China is a critical level, because that's what I also believe. Because one of the things that we have today is a distorted interest rate. And that's changing because the concept of inflation. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a piece in Barron's recently that was saying one of the key people will talk about Volcker because he's a name that comes up a lot because we've got inflation today and people are reminded of, mm-hmm. you know, what he had to do back then. But I'd say the thing that broke inflation wasn't Volcker, wasn't Fed policy. It was China. It was the Chinese economy, the growth of the Chinese economy, and pretty much everything that's, you know, was made in the rest of the world ended up gravitating a lot of it to China because China was the low cost producer. And so I also think that the maturation of China, you know, the fact that it's an emerging market, it's considered an emerging market, that doesn't make any sense. It's a mature economy. And so, and you know, the maturity of that economy is changing it fundamentally, it seems to me. And that's what I thought 12 years ago when I started to go there. You know, a lot of the things that made them what they are different today, whether that's the population, whether that's, you know, they built out so much industry. You know, so one of the areas we do invest in regularly is energy, conventional fossil fuels. And you know, and when you look at China, of course, so many things they do, right? They're 50% of everything. So 50% of the steel production in the world. And yet today, what are the critical elements in making steel? The variable costs are metallurgical coal, it's iron ore, and it's energy. And in those three things, China used to be self-sufficient. They're not self-sufficient anymore. At the margin, they're importing each of those things. And so therefore, to have a 50% producer of a product, and that's what it is for many things, they're 50%, their costs are going up, right? And you've seen that. The producer price index in China has just gone through the roof in the last year or so. So therefore, that's changing and a critical element. That's what I kind of think. The low-cost provider, China, is suddenly seeing its own inflation, and therefore its prices are rising. So everyone else's prices are rising. So that's why I kind of think inflation is not a transitory thing. There are structural things going on, and China is clearly one of them. Investing in China, that's something that I have not done, do not do, have concerns about it. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, and again, it's just not my expertise and it's not my understanding. And understanding the Chinese psyche, mentality, and how they run those businesses, I always thought it was deceptive. When you visit Asia and you talk to a management that speaks English well, you think they think like you do. The fact of the matter is, you know, we're focused on return on capital and return on equity. The fact of the matter is, many Asian countries, that's not how those businesses are run, and that's not the primary determination as what they want to do with that business.
Yeah, those are very interesting comments. And I had actually not thought through that. And I'll have to read your piece in Barron's. That sounds very interesting. And I will do so after the podcast. I'm going to encourage our listeners to read the piece in Barron's. What is the title of it?
Forget what it is.
Yeah. That's okay. We'll find it. And I will add it to the show notes so that our listeners can read the piece if they are interested.
But China is a critical element of why also I'm invested so much in North America. I should say North America, not the United States, North America. And the reason I say that is an observation I would have is that the world's demands for energy in all forms are extremely strong today. And you saw that long before Russia invaded Ukraine, all of Europe and Asia, you know, the prices of natural gas, LNG, and coal actually were significant premiums to oil prices. And so therefore, that is an important driver of all industry, is what's the energy costs of those businesses. And energy costs in China are A, very expensive, B, power was in strong demand and limited supply, right? There were curtailments, you know, 6 months ago in a lot of different industries as China was concerned about how they were going to get power, concerned how they were going to, if they were going to burn coal, how that was going to affect Beijing and the Beijing Olympics. All these things played in. And so therefore you saw strong demand for energy and the straining of the ability to supply that. And so that's the difference for North America. We actually have an overabundance of fossil fuels. And that is primarily natural gas. And so that really, energy-intensive businesses in North America are competitively advantaged against the rest of the world. That's a huge competitive structural situation that isn't going to change anytime soon. And it's become more critical given the demands for power. And power is everything, because we need everything, right? We need renewables. We need to somehow figure out how to mitigate CO2 production, without a doubt. And so, but how do you do that is complicated. It's all incrementalism and mitigation. Because again, another hurdle to China is 2/3 of their power comes from coal. And what have they done in the last year? They've substantially increased the amount of coal that they're mining and burning. So therefore, there's a cost to that. And that cost is being recognized by people, I think. That's an extra burden that China has that will continue to kind of weigh on it, I do think.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about investing in conventional fossil fuels, and I think, I don't know for sure, but I suspect we have probably a similar viewpoint on ESG. But do you have any comments on the growth of ESG and sort of the greenwashing that we're seeing, or how do you factor that in to your analysis when you're dealing with these conventional fossil fuel companies?
Yeah, the most important thing, first off, I really believe we need everything. So the idea that we need more renewables makes sense. I understand that. I also think the fact of the matter is higher prices of fossil fuels is good, because that will accelerate and increase the economics of renewables. So therefore, it is part of the equation. That's the problem I have. The problem I have is that the farmers and the ranchers have to be friends. There's no white and black. This is bad and that is good. It's all mitigation in my mind, right? Because as I said, you look at the developing world and India and China, they burn coal. And the idea that you can convert that coal consumption to natural gas, is natural gas is still a fossil fuel. We all know that. It all produces carbon, but it produces half the carbon that coal does. So therefore, how do you mitigate things? And you can't build out the renewables quick enough. So that's the problem with ESG. It's confusing, I think, what we all need to do to have also affordable and reliable energy availability. What happened in Europe in the fall of last year is potentially a cautionary tale that, what do you do? And you've seen, of course, reactions in Europe, who clearly are more green than America, saying, well, gee, there are things that we were not going to consider, but we realize we really need to consider those things. So I think there's a new conversation that's really has to happen, because it's a broader, not a single dimensional issue. It's not just CO2 production. There's how do you mitigate that? And how do you still have reliable power to heat homes and do all the things you need to do and drive industry? So that's unfortunately going to be complicated, because people aren't willing to make compromises today. But I think you need to do that.
It is a very complicated subject, ESG. Yeah. Even the reporting alone is complicated with no really standardization and disclosures, et cetera. So
it does seem, since I'm on the board of a couple of energy companies, we spend an extensive amount of time trying to grapple with the issue and trying to get our arms around it. And so it does seem as if we're making reasonable progress. And I also think the same thing. I think, how do you mitigate? Because that's one of the things in mitigation is like, well, you mitigate it with the guy who's producing the product. And so oil and gas companies are part of the solution, in terms of things like methane leakage. So therefore, for the industry to do something, to implement rules, to understand that, to take advantage of that. And to a certain extent, I do think the economic environment also drives advantageous things environmentally, right? In the last 10 years, the United States produces and consumes twice the natural gas it did 10 years ago. A lot of that natural gas displaced coal production. And so therefore, coal burning in America declined. CO2 output from the United States declined in a decade. Not why? Not regulatory requirements. Economics. Economics of low-cost natural gas displaced coal. And so, that's part of the equation. And so I think there's other opportunities there. How do you mitigate that? And natural gas prices everywhere, even in North America, are higher. And what is methane? Methane is natural gas. So those are the same thing. So therefore, the higher price of it, making it more economic, means, well, the industry is motivated economically to figure out how to capture methane, how to use methane, how to not flare methane. So therefore, compliance in ESG things drive better improved economics. So I do think that that's, part of it self-curing higher prices means that some of these things, the industry has the ability and is beginning to address, and therefore providing part of the solution to ESG concerns and problems.
Yeah, it's It's interesting that the most interesting ESG strategy I've heard came from a well-known manager. I won't say his name. I don't know that he wants me to disclose his strategy, but he's a very good investor in emerging markets. And he goes into emerging economies and he takes large positions in companies, usually in an activist role. And these companies have very low ESG ratings. And then he pushes the management to make changes to increase the ESG ratings, which produces some alpha in the stock price. So I thought that was a very interesting way to look at ESG. But I see that you serve on several company boards, and I've heard you mention in the past your willingness to become an active shareholder, engaging with management and the board when it makes sense. What have been some really important lessons from these experiences as an activist or just a board member?
Well, there's a number of, part of the logic is we're invested in a company. We think that's what it is. So we're investing in these cyclicals, right? We think we've invested in them when there is, it's a difficult environment and there's plenty of opportunities in a difficult environment, right? And how do you do that intelligently? How do you allocate capital? How do you grow the business? How do you consolidate? So that's part of the thing. There's a cathartic internal process, how the company improves its position, and then how consolidation plays into that too, to therefore winnow down the competitive landscape, improve and deploy capital at times where you can buy assets and acquire assets for far less than what it would cost to build those assets new, assuming those assets and understanding those assets have value. So therefore, to have a seat at the table in terms of how the business is run, how to allocate capital, clearly, I think we had at the margin some value. And of course, I'm going to be in it for an extended period of time. So therefore, it's not like, well, okay, there's a trade-off, right? The fact that I am a board member means I'm going to be restricted at various times. So I'm not going to be able to do things. And so, but given I'm not interested in trading around the position, that's an irrelevancy. I can't trade in the stock. And there'll be opportunities if I want to acquire more to do that. At the same time, what it does is, of course, a more expansive understanding of the industry. So the components of the business, how it fits together, who the people are that drive that company and other companies. So the kind of the wealth of information you get from a different perspective as a board member of a company fully forms my view and understanding of the industry. So when I was in the board of BMC, that's the entry point that we had into investing in Oriented Strand Board. We saw the dynamics in the business. We saw the entry point when they brought on plants prematurely and oversupplied the market and the prices came down and the profitability came down. We can still understand the longer term dynamics are, that market was consolidated, limited amount of incremental capacity. At some point, the capacity probably is going to be fully utilized. Therefore, the industry would have strong pricing power. So therefore, we identified entry points into other investments. And so when those two companies merged, the consolidated position that industry has transformed that industry and that company. And so we think we understood the dynamics. We played some role in that process too. So that's part of our logic for being on boards when we have these investments that are really long-term in nature.
Yeah. So I'm on three boards of publicly traded companies, and it's very interesting. They're all three different. There's a different culture with every board. But I'm assuming that you feel that board membership has improved your ability to analyze companies or make judgments as a minority investor. Is that so?
Absolutely. And it does give insight into the people, because the people part of any business are a critical element. And you know some things from in the public domain. And you know a lot more when you're kind of in the boardroom with somebody and the specifics on that company. But of course, some of those rules of people and how they work and what they do and how they function and how boards function, there's some universality to that too. So I can understand other situations better, what the dynamics might be, not for sure what they are, but what they might be, and to get insight into the company and the opportunity as a result.
Yeah, I know. And I'm sure you're not an investor in Twitter, and neither am I. But over the past few weeks, I've thought, gosh, wouldn't it be fun to be on the Twitter board right now and all the conversations and phone calls and emails they're having? That must have been a very interesting experience. But I want to go back to your comments on cyclicals. And regarding cyclicals, one question that comes to mind is how you weigh changes in the cycle in your thesis if it appears to be maturing. Take, for instance, rising interest rates. Does this affect your thesis on housing-related stocks, or is it driven more strongly by long-term fundamentals? Do you think interest rates will choke off growth in the housing industry, or we just have a lot of undersupply and that your positions in the housing stocks will continue to perform well?
So every industry, every situation is dynamic and it has to be individually analyzed. Our view on the housing business is that that's what you really have. You have the demographics and the demand for homes today for a house, for a household to live in, is significantly greater, or it absorbs whatever supply there is. So the housing industry clearly has slowed down some. And that's a great thing also. Having invested in it since 2009 is when we first made large investments in it. There's inevitably periods of time where things slow down. It gets ahead of itself, whether that's the business itself, and then capital follows it. And then when it slows down, the capital got in for a cyclical trade out of it. And so therefore the stocks come down. So you've seen that this year. So housing related stocks have really compressed in terms of valuations based on historical earnings. And of course the concern is that's it. The goose is over. You know, there's no future outlook, or it's a significantly dampened and different. Our view is interest rates are one of the components. The fact of the matter is there's a shortage of homes and people need to live someplace. So what that means is, okay, instead of buying a home, we're going to rent a home. And so therefore rental rates, of course, are up dramatically. Rental rates then affect, do you purchase a home? Because it's a buy, sell, this, a buy rent decision. And so therefore there's still plenty of interest. The demand is there for housing. Another factor that's entering into housing today that I don't think the market fully appreciates is it's the entry of the build-to-rent business. So, that industry popped up post the financial crisis. So with all of those homes that were overbuilt, many of those ended up being bought by these public companies. And, of course, that's been an extremely successful investment category. And so the multifamily, of course, is a well-established business in it, and the REIT component to that is a very large piece of it. The build-to-rent business on single-family homes, we think, has a lot of attractive attributes to it, and that industry is extremely well-financed. So, and they're not getting a home mortgage, and their problem is availability of supply. So to the extent that there's an individual home buyer who's potentially not in a position to be able to buy that home temporarily, some of that we think is going to definitely be absorbed by this industry that is looking for the entry point. How do I get more homes? So we think that that's clearly a mitigating factor. The other thing is the industry is extremely constrained today. So, we talked to one of the major lumber companies recently, and what he complained about was, the distributors just hold no inventory anymore. They just order from it just in time. So inventory channels are extremely light. There's no available homes for sale in the new market that kind of haven't gone sold. So the availability of product is extremely limited. And so even if there is a quarter or two or some period of time of slowdown in the business, we think that the opportunity is strong and will prevail. In the meantime, the balance sheets of these companies, that's a critical thing also, is there's fewer suppliers who are rational competitors who will moderate production and have balance sheets where they can do that. So the financial wherewithal of these companies, and therefore the margin of safety that you get given their balance sheets and their situations today, mitigates the fact, and actually the price decline we think creates significant opportunity for someone over a 3 to 5 year time frame to buy businesses that are well positioned, well managed, in a consolidated business that the demand for the product is clearly there and unsatiated.
Oh, that's very interesting. Thank you. That's a very thorough thesis. And again, similar to your thesis that I've heard you present on Westlake, do you want to review that with listeners, what your thesis is on that stock?
Sure. Again, it's a company that trades at single-digit PE multiples, and it's got insider ownership. The Chow family owns 70% of the money. They generate significant free cash flow. The businesses are chloralkali, they make caustic soda, they make chlorine, they're integrated into the chlorine business, so therefore they make PVC, and then they acquired companies that make PVC pipe, and then they've acquired companies that have building products that use vinyls to them, and more recently, last year, they made four acquisitions, and one of those was Boral North America, so they bought the North American component of an Australian-based company that probably was undermanaged, and they have a history of that too. in capital allocation with strong free cash flows. They bought things repeatedly, and they bought things repeatedly from people who were undercapitalized, undermanaged, and therefore opportunities to relatively straightforwardly improve the operations through intelligent management and relatively modest capital allocation to therefore demodel like businesses to take advantage of inherent opportunities past managements didn't. So therefore, their model of what they do and how they, and that's one of the key things. Not only is it very inexpensive on valuation, generating a lot of free cash flow, they have a history of deploying that capital extremely intelligently to continue to incrementally grow. And that's what it is. This is a, quote, cyclical business that, you know, over the last 10 years has grown revenues 14% compounded. It's grown EBITDA at probably 19% compounded. It's grown free cash flow 24% compounded. The return on capital has been, you know, over 20%. So strong numbers. And all of that with the same shareholder account. So therefore, they didn't issue shares to do with that growth. So therefore, that's a really great record. And the idea that that company would trade for a single PE digit multiple is a little bit interesting. Now part of that is because everyone thinks it's a cyclical business and we're not paying 6 or 7 times earnings. We're really paying 20 times earnings because the earnings are going to slump.
Right.
That's a repeated opportunity, we think, in industrials in America. There are so many industries that have gone through a decade, 2 decades of poor performance, poor capital returns. What they've done is they've right-sided supply. They've matched the business to what the demand is. In the process, too, those companies have consolidated. And what have they done? Because it's an extended period of difficulty, they've done that again. They've downsized. They've right-sized. They've consolidated. So today, many of these industries have a very different industrial position than they've ever had. So, for example, in Westlake Chemical, one of the core businesses is that chloralkali business. In chloralkali, right, the key components and the elements to make that are low-cost electricity and salt, you know, prosaic things. The fact of the matter is low-cost energy power is lower in America than it is in most of the world. And so, therefore, the cost structure of the U.S. competitors is substantially advantaged over the rest of the developed world. So we're the low-cost producer of this product. There is only 3 people who probably supply 90% of the market for chloralkali, for caustic soda and for chlorines. So because of that, you have a very rational industry. The fact of the matter is today, the supply is fully being utilized. Imports are not competitive. Pricing power is there. And so And Sherwin Williams may have problems selling paint because they can't get TiO2 and may say in a quarterly conference call that we may build our own TiO2 plant. I can tell you that Sherwin Williams shareholders jump up and down and go crazy at the concept that they would build a TiO2 plant because that is a basic commodity that we don't want to be in commodity businesses. We have a differentiated product. And so, but capital discipline has provided some of these opportunities. That's what happened in chloralkali, mm-hmm. Right? It was the merger of Dow and DuPont, where they said, we don't want to be in that business anymore. That's a commodity cyclical business. So they got rid of it and put it into Olin. And they said, we want to be in the specialties, you know, higher margins, higher returns on capital, which makes sense. The fact of the matter is, you now have a basic commodity that you don't have and you're not fully integrated. And therefore, and you have to go to one of these guys as a source of supply. Now, for the time being, it's okay because you have a 10-year agreement that you struck with them that you're buying it below cost or below market today. Mm-hmm. But what's going to happen when that contract runs out?
Yeah.
You need that product. And that industry now has that competitive end. So even people getting out of businesses and, you know, disaggregating things and getting rid of that vertical integration, in the process and in the time, it was great. The fact of the matter is, what's the longer term impact of that? They may have structural problems that will cause you and enable these people to be able to reap an appropriate return on capital for, you know, what it would cost to build that. And there's barriers to entry environmentally. To go mm-hmm. build plants like these are not things that are environmentally friendly. And so therefore, the sustainability of kind of the structural change that's happened in these, a lot of these businesses, we think there's a persistency to it that you wouldn't otherwise think there would be.
Yeah.
So that's another – yeah, it's great, but how long does it last? I think it lasts a lot longer than people think it is.
Yeah, well, it makes sense. And I guess we'll see more of a trend to – vertical integration over the next cycle, and I would suspect that we would see more of that, and it's an opportunity maybe for acquisitions in the future.
Mm-hmm. But to re-aggregate these things, of course, might make sense. And maybe it's a better business. Dow and DuPont kind of want to buy it then, because now, hey, I'm only one of three guys, and it's a critical element. So A, I supply myself at a cost advantage over my competitors. And if I want to sell to somebody else, there's demand for the product. So it may make more sense once you've disaggregated, because then it's gone through its own cathartic process. And then suddenly it's an attractive business to put back together.
Yeah. So, well, yeah. That's what Wall Street's based off of, right? So Wall Street really gets fees all the way around, all the way around. So what are some of the most important lessons you've learned as an investor that have impacted your thinking and approach to investing, Bob?
So the most important thing is in pretty much every investment that we've done well over time, are investments that we've done poorly initially, and I've lost a lot of money in it because I've had a thesis on, okay, so here's the opportunity, here's the entry point, it is a cyclical business. The fact of the matter is, when things are going poorly for a company and industry, things go poorly. It just gets worse, but the persistency to say, okay, and even in the situation where once or twice I've been in the manufactured housing industry, is an industry that I invested in back in 2003 and 4 and 5, and the thesis there was way premature. Today, that's a phenomenal business that I think has really huge competitive advantages and really, an interesting future. Then, but I lost a lot of money, and in that process, though, what we did was, well, we bought more Cavco, because Cavco bought Champion. It bought Palm Harbor. So the companies that didn't work out and financially were distressed and couldn't make it through the process ended up being part of another company. So that cathartic consolidation process, you got to make sure that you continue to hold to the investment and stay invested and invest more money, because that's what it is. Your entry point into the business then becomes probably more attractive, and that fundamentals of the business that is the consolidator remainer in the business, who also clearly was well managed because that was what put him in that position. So staying with things in spite of mark-to-market losses and even financial difficulties, and seeing the opportunity for it to come together. Because that's what it is. We're a growth investor. We're not a value investor, to be honest with you, right? We're looking to buy businesses that we think have tremendous growth in front of them. Now, that growth may be predicated on the idea that it's a cyclical business that has a huge recovery. And housing, right, mm-hmm. when we did it in 09 and 10 and 11, clearly was that. This is an industry that has, there's a permanency to it. This is not a buggy whip. It isn't going away. And we were early to that process, but we stayed with it. So that's a critical element of the cyclical investing we do have, is to have that behavioral kind of capability to say, I can tolerate a mark-to-market loss. I can even tolerate a capital loss if I can then redeploy capital and double down in an opportunity that definitely is going to have a recovery in it. And then I see that today in energy, right? The oil and gas, a lot of the things we do, are things that – and that's what also happens, right? So it's not only the companies improving the process – through that and consolidation, but also the stock prices just continue to go lower because stocks, and that's one of the things that's really creating some opportunity today. We talk about the myopia of linear thinking, that you've had a 10 plus pandemic year period of consistency of situation. And therefore the price of securities have gotten far off kilter to what the underlying business is worth and what it would cost to replicate that business, because it hasn't been generating a return. And since it doesn't generate a return, well, I know I mark it down. And each time I do that, I mark it down further. And therefore, the disparity between price and value just gets wider and wider and wider. And of course, the longer it moves along through that period, the closer you are probably to a recovery, as hard as it is to kind of time that. You kind of can't. But the opportunity set gets greater, not smaller, we would think. So, I think Tidewater, which I'm on the board of, recently closed an acquisition. I think, the acquisition's a phenomenal acquisition. For $200 million, we bought assets that would cost $2 billion to build probably today, and probably more than that. And the assets alone that they have, but those assets haven't been generating much money. They've just been breaking even for years. So how do you value an asset that's just breaking even? Well, you discount it because it performs poorly, and you just continue to discount it. The separation, because the value of those assets, we think, are multiples of where the current stock price is. The balance sheet is such that they clearly are going to come out the other end. And actually, of course, we think that, we are clearly at the inception and a substantial recovery in that business. And the other thing is, in a lot of these commodity businesses, right, one of the rules of thumb is the cure for high prices is high prices. And of course, the concept there is once a cyclical business gets high prices, then that means they get high returns. That means new capital comes in. And therefore, that destroys it, creates the next capital cycle. Well, in a lot of these businesses today, I suggest that there's a lot of reasons to think that high prices aren't going to be the cure for high prices. Because who wants to build a new offshore boat servicing offshore drilling rigs in an industry that what the future is 10 years from now? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And you know, and I don't know what to, if I build a new boat, I don't know what to build because what's my power source for that boat? What's the fuel that I'm going to run that on? I don't know. And so you can't build the 20-year asset when you don't have that kind of vision and visibility. So therefore, the demand for these products are definitely changing dramatically. Pricing is improving to the point where normally you'd get the beginning of the next capital flow. And high prices isn't going to bring in new capital so quickly. And so therefore, there's more persistence to the high earnings than you normally would get in these cyclical businesses. So, or in the case of chloralkali, you've got a consolidated industry that therefore they're not going to kill the goose laying the gold today. So, and you can't enter into that business as a new participant. So therefore, that's also a different dynamic that you have in a number of situations.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Higher barriers to entry and new competition will be slower or less likely to come in just because there's not clarity on what the regulatory environment will be like or many of the other issues that you mentioned. That's all fascinating. And I loved your comment about, well, we're growth investors. And I do think that's often misunderstood, this whole value versus growth conversation gets a bit old. You know, Sir John Templeton was a growth investor.
Right.
Even though, you know, many people think of him as value investors, he loved growth. He was just very careful with what he paid for it, which brings us back to the beginning of our conversation. Valuations matter. It matters what you pay for an asset, period.
Right.
But we also like growth. Well, in this very volatile environment, I'm sure some investors are starting to get pretty uncomfortable. Do you have any advice for just the average investor in this market?
Yeah, I do. I do. You know, it's concerning. It concerns me. So I sit on a couple of committees, and some of the committees oversee the pension. And so therefore, you look at kind of pension money. And so, of course, what you see is the predominance of target date funds is the adopted thing where so much capital is flying into that. And it was highlighted to me recently because one of the committees that I'm on, we have a terminated plan that we're moving the assets from the terminated plan into a new plan. And so therefore we have to map it from where they are invested today to where we're going to put them to be invested. And so there was particularly a situation where there were people who were invested in a all equity Latin America fund. And we're going to map them into the target date fund. Now, to the extent that that's a person who's 60, 65 years old, that means that 60% of their money is going to go into fixed income. The interest rates are wrong. The fixed income market is mispriced. And, of course, that's fundamental that affects all markets, right? Because that's your base risk-free rate of return is not accurately stated.
Right.
And so, and that's in the process. And you saw that in the first quarter. Fixed income, you know, had horrible
performance. Awful, yeah.
Yeah, the idea that that could happen for an extended period of time, really, you know, there's definitely that risk out there. So the idea that this 60-40 thing makes sense, it seems to me as if it once in every 100 or 1,000 years, it doesn't make sense. And maybe we're at that once in 1,000 years. And yet the people are telling me, they said, but Bob, if you map them into an equity fund versus that target day fund, you potentially have liability because that's the safe harbor if you put them into that. And so clearly that means money gravitates into these investments that intuitively have risk to them that is really sizable. And yet the capital continues to move that way. So that's a concerning thing for all investors thinking about anything that's income related, yield related. I do think that, you know, if inflation does hold, it has persistency. That's what we see, right? We talk about grassroots macroeconomics, and that is looking at the companies we know and understanding those businesses. We understand pricing for chlorine and caustic soda are up dramatically and have the reasons to believe they're staying there. They're not going down. So it's a supply issue. It's not a supply chain issue. It's a supply issue. Many situations today are supply issues. Supply has been balanced to market demand and therefore has pricing power. price, one man's pricing power, another man's inflation. So the persistency of inflation, we think, has the risk of being substantial. That means anything yield related could be well off for where it needs to be. And that means risk of capital loss.
Oh, I know. It's scary that people, I think, have an idea that you can't lose money in bonds or fixed income.
Right.
It's like, whoa, you can lose a lot of money there.
So the phrase we love, you know this guy, Rudiger Dornbusch, the economist who said, in economics, things take longer to happen than you think they will.
Yeah.
But when they do, they happen faster than you think they could. Capital's in the wrong place today because of a decade plus pandemic period of persistency and certain results has created a myopia and linear thinking by people to get comfort in things that have huge amounts of risk that they've forgotten about and are latent and are starting to come to the surface. And people are hoping they're transitory. You know, and the idea that they're transitory, that's a really risky proposition.
Yeah. I agree. We see it from the same vantage point. Low interest rates have really encouraged a lot of risk taking. It's really incredible, some of the risk we've seen. So I think it's a good time for investors to be cautious and to look for businesses that have pricing power. And, you know, we always tell people, I mean, I would completely avoid the fixed income markets right now.
Right.
Well,
so those are two things, right? One is the continued thing is we think it's the revenge of the old economy. And so therefore there are things that have happened over time. There are structural changes, but we also think it's the revenge of the stock picker. You know, it's kind of like companies are all different and who's in an advantage position, who has pricing power. You have to do fundamental bottom up research to understand that dynamic. And that's a critical thing, especially as capital's moving. You're where to go to, and it's going to be company specific, not just sector specific.
Yeah. And which companies have a well-positioned balance sheet or not completely reliant on the kindness of others to finance their business will be important in a rising interest rate environment. Yeah. And I love the revenge of the stock picker. That's what we'll call today's session because it's about time. Right, Bob?
As Graham quoted Horace, right, what we're seeing is the restoration of the fallen, while those who are in glory find earth below.
I love it. That's awesome. Well, I look forward to seeing you in Omaha this weekend. I hope we bump into each other among the 40,000 other people that will be there. But I'm quite sure I probably will see you. And just want to thank you again for the time you've spent with us today. Where can my listeners learn more about your business, read more about your thoughts on investing, or follow you on social media?
Well, we do have a website, www.rabati.com. And, it does have a bunch of the articles. So, the interview in Barron's we did, there was an article in the Toronto Star, courtesy of Paul Rivette owning the Tour Star. And, a couple of letters and an interview in Value Investing Insight we had done in the end of February, where we talk about that's more stock specific as opposed to, kind of the macro overlay that we think is conducive after a decade of being a poor environment for companies lumped into the category of value. Suddenly now the companies lumped into that category probably have tailwinds from an economic activity.
Great. Well, I'm sure all of my listeners will visit your website. You do sound rather old economy with the www dot. But thank you for joining us today, Bob. It's been a real treat to have you on. And I will see you soon in Omaha.
Okay. See you tomorrow, pretty much.
Okay.
Okay. Very good.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Investing the Templeton Way. Please be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast player. To view the show notes and resources mentioned in today's show, head to investingthetempletonway.com.